Welcome to CBAW Loves, a book club podcast from Community Building Artworks. I'm Seema Reza.
And I'm Amelia Bain. Each episode, Seema and I will invite a rotating cast of fellow writers and artists to discuss a book that we love.
We hope you'll read along and join the conversation.
You're listening to part two of our series on the book Who is Wellness For? This discussion episode features Tarfia Faizula, Nisha Gupta, and Rachel Heath. We start our discussion by asking the question, how are you currently thinking about wellness? And from there, we touch on many, many topics that I can't wait for you to hear. But for now, let's get started with my co-host, Seema Reza, answering the question, how are you currently thinking about wellness?
Wellness is a word that I have had like a really mixed relationship with. You know, there's like all of this stuff that I do that's within wellness, but it has felt really like, I don't know, I felt embarrassed by it. I think in a lot of ways, as it's become sort of ubiquitous and used for things that are not necessarily healthy, I've been thinking like as a survivor of Earth, about how like everything that I choose to do outside of like the stuff I have to do should be therapeutic. Like even eating junk food sometimes is the therapeutic thing to do. Is Cheetos are my like, right? Like this is the thing. And so that's been this sort of evolving thing that I have between punishing myself for not being healthy and also like reminding myself that I can make some choices that are for a goodness that isn't necessarily like what's traditionally healthy.
Hi, I'm Nisha. I am a psychology professor, a clinical psychologist. So I was trained as a therapist in the West. And so, you know, I enjoyed this book because when I think about wellness, I'm undergoing currently a radical shift in my understanding of wellness from the perspective of being a psychotherapist. You know, trained to diagnose people, to diagnose myself, to try to make sure people are mentally healthy and what that means, mental health. And more recently, I've been like really trying to value and embrace the wisdom of madness and the wisdom of that comes from trauma. And so that might, you know, the Eastern approaches to wellness or psychology, you know, Indian psychology really appeals to me. So the book was awesome to read in light of that.
My name is Rachel Heath, or Ray. I am the director of curriculum and coaching for the Unicorn Authors Club. I'm also a writer. I'm also a yoga teacher. I'm also a meditation instructor. I also have a podcast about wellness. So I think about wellness a lot. And I think about wellness specifically through the lens of how marginalized people are removed from the wellness space. And my podcast is called Black Women in Wellness. And the whole point was to shine a light on Black women wellness workers. And there's so much traditional indigenous knowledge around wellness that has been co-opted and turned into commodities. And the people who those things were stolen from have been removed from the conversation and are not represented at all. And I think that Black women are a huge part of that. So I really enjoyed this book. It also caused me to kind of examine some of the lineages of study of wellness that I am a part of. And I've been actively trying to dismantle those, but we live in these systems, so it's hard. So wellness is a big part of my life. I do a lot of work with clients and students to help them try and dismantle their ideas about wellness so that they can come to their own conclusions and path. I'm really excited to just get into this conversation.
I'm Tarfia. I'm a writer. I write poetry and I'm kind of like a, you know, I'm like a really big geek. And so I think that part of my relationship to wellness is also part of my relationship to solitude and being an introvert, who's like oftentimes more comfortable with like books than I am around people, or it's sort of like figuring out those juxtapositions, I guess.
I'd love to talk about like maybe how the book has impacted your thinking about these topics, or just like what happened to you as you were reading the book. I know I like at the beginning felt like I felt uncomfortable because like there were things that I was invested in while also like setting myself apart from, which I think Rachel, like, you know, like we're trying to dismantle, we're trying to be apart, but also like, oh shit, oh, I'm doing this mindful app, you know, or whatever the thing is.
Yeah, I also, it took me a moment to be able to kind of shut off that voice of what I expected a book about wellness to be, and to really be able to receive what was being presented. The story was so personal, and so many of the wellness books that I've read through, the personal is taken out of it. You know, even those that are trying to like dismantle what wellness is, it's like, we're just going to tell you what our method is, as opposed to like really making the story a part of the conversation. And I mean, if wellness isn't about our own personal experiences, then what is it? But there was that kind of push-pull for me as well, where I was like, when is she going to get to the point? I had to check myself.
Yes, because it's like, usually it's you, but this was like I, and you're like, oh, right, of course. Yeah. There's an I that's talking to the you.
Yeah, I had a, like, I mean, a very different experience, I'm sure, but like, I would similarly call it discomfort at the beginning, right? Like, there was a lot of even things that I have found helpful, where it was like, okay, well, it helped me, but I need to think about it in a greater context.
Yeah, I felt also uncomfortable. But what I loved was in the book, somewhere midway through, she says, you know, I'm aware that this is going to make people, my truth makes people uncomfortable. And I've just found it to, you know, I'm usually the person like walking through the world afraid of making everyone uncomfortable with like depths of truth. And to then experience myself being uncomfortable by somebody else's depth was like a relief that just put me in like humanity, right? We're all, you know, this is just what truth does. And the truthier you get with truth, the more uncomfortable it is. But I've always felt like sanity rests on truth. And so like, bravo to this book for being one of the most sane books I've ever read.
I guess I was sort of, you know, I'm friendly with Fariha. You know, it's, I think like as someone who cares about her personally, it was very painful to read about her experiences in a whole other kind of way. And then also sometimes to identify with those experiences was also painful. And not all of them, but I think, you know, she's the vacillation that's happening between her personal experience and where she is directing her attention and, you know, for lack of a better word, her flashlight. Like, I just think like, I just think this book is very fascinating in that way. And like, you're sort of like watching almost, it feels very interactive, strangely, like you're sort of like experiencing in real time someone like struggling to name both internal and individual experience and external experience at the same time with a lot of research. Like, she's like clearly read so much in order to write this book. So yeah.
Yeah, there was such clarity of like logic and thought, like to Nisha's point, right? Like, such a sane book in this way. There's like, all these things are being valued equally, right? And one of the things that came up for me is, I'm a woman who's been doing yoga for probably like 25 years, right? Like, and pretty seriously over the past decade, like it's been a part of my process. And I have also felt like eye roll about yoga culture and like, you know, I stay in the four corners of my mat to like to a very unfriendly degree at the, you know, like I go to the studio, but like, I'm not trying to make friends and like, which is like very un-yoga. But it's, and it's, I think like part of it for me has been, I was raised Muslim. So like, I'm from South Asia, but I was raised Muslim and I feel like I'm sometimes appropriating yoga, even I feel like I'm appropriating yoga, right? Like, I don't know exactly when we turned Muslim, like what generation, how many generations ago, but it feels this way. And as I was reading this book, I was been thinking about just how we do this thing where we're like, oh, I don't belong there. And I don't like, I have to belong where I exactly belong, or that where I have a right to, what I have a right to claim. But actually, like, maybe we should have access to all of it. Maybe that's the liberation that comes despite colonization, despite enslavement. It's like, all right, now we're here and all of our knowledge can be pooled.
I love that you brought up yoga and yoga culture, because when I was reading her thoughts about that, my initial response was, so does that mean that everything that I've learned has been an appropriation and is now invalid? I had some really extreme moments with this book, and I had to like bring it back, and I was like, wait a minute. But it's also like that conversation that very similar conversation that you had, where it's like, but I'm a marginalized person and I'm an oppressed person. And isn't it okay for me to be doing this because I need healing too? And I was like, all right, where is all of this frustration coming from? You know, she's speaking a truth that is her truth, and she's offering information, and she's shining, you know, Tarpia, you mentioned where she's shining the flashlight. She's shining her flashlight in the spot that's obviously a tender spot for you. But when we think about these practices and we think about how we incorporate them into our lives, there's so many questions around like purpose and intention and how we're like representing the practice and ourselves within it. But there's also the benefit of the practice itself, right? And what we can put it in a million different containers. What's really important is that we're doing our wellness, that we're doing our healing, whatever it looks like for us, right? So it's this fine balance between being respectful, but also remembering that you're a person who has needs. And there's like no real like right answer for it. And there doesn't have to be.
I want to chime in as a Hindu on this whole conversation, because I find the whole question of cultural appropriation with yoga to be fascinating, and yoga and meditation, which is yoga, because, you know, the way I was taught yoga from my grandmother and my aunties, whatever, and even Hinduism, is that Hinduism originally wasn't a religion. So it was a philosophy, Indian philosophy or a philosophical approach, in which yoga was the philosophical practice, you know, the practice of it. And there was a desire for it to spread across the globe. So you hear the difference, right? That's actually that was the point of the practice. And then as Hinduism became a religion, I believe because we were told we were a religion from colonizers. In some sense, there's something that was put onto, you know, I don't know the exact history of that, but then it became a religion from an outside, and then became a religion, right? But there's also a sense of like Hinduism contained Jesus Christ, his Hinduism contained Buddha, his Hinduism contained what was inclusive of all. So that is a very specific understanding then of that, like, Hindu practices that is a little different than how I understand also other cultural and religious cultural appropriation struggles and issues. So however, then what like I'm seeing as the big issue here in the US is not that there are people that aren't Hindu or Indian doing yoga. I think that's the point of it. That was the purpose. I think it's that it's become used for the opposite aims of yoga as a philosophy. And I think that's what I really heard Farya saying when she was going back to the lineage, was like, you have to understand Indian philosophy and what the point of these practices are beyond the like hot bod, or even like, oh, like taking, you know, being more productive at work. So like, you know, one of the grossest classes I had, where I was the only person of color in a New York City yoga studio, was that, you know, it was very much yoga for capitalism. And that's the issue I'm seeing, really. And I think the other issue I'm seeing is that a lot of Indian people and a lot of Hindu people have become so disconnected from yoga itself as well.
Thank you for shining a light on that. And I know when I was doing my training, it was very much, we're going to study the roots and we are not just going to do asana. We're not just going to do vinyasa. We're going to look at all parts of this eightfold path. And we're also going to look at bhakti yoga. And we're also going to look at raja yoga. And we're going to look at how this is really a world of study and paths towards enlightenment. I see now with a lot of yoga trainings being very popular that that is not the case. And it's really, again, coming back to capitalism, right? Like, how can we make this a product that we can sell to people that are then going to go and sell this idea of what yoga is to other people? And it just perpetuates itself.
First of all, yoga for capitalism is, I don't know why I did this. Like, it would be a t-shirt. It'd be a terrible t-shirt. Nobody wear that t-shirt. But I've been thinking about, like, you know, like, so this book inspired me to read the Mahabharata, right? Which I had, like, you know, we lived in India when I was a kid for a little while and, like, you know, I was exposed to it, but it was always this, like, also we're Muslim. So there was always this curiosity that was sort of fenced by this, I don't know, like, caution, right? Because of just, like, our history with partition. And this book gave me this permission to be like, no, that too, this is part of my lineage. It's okay that, like, some ancestor somewhere decided that, like, and maybe not some ancestor somewhere, some colonizer somewhere was like, you are this and not this. And to be this, you have to, like, go of this. And that's been such, that was such a gift. Like, in a way, there was that discomfort reading the book, but also this permission to be like, no, study deeper, like, get in there, which has been great.
Yeah, I think some of what she's asking us to do is sort of like, when was the last time you really thought about this thing that you more or less take for granted? And the yoga thing is really funny to me, I guess, because I've been asked by so many white women to go to yoga class with them. Never other people of color, though. Like, literally, it's just like, I've been asked by, and it's always, you should come to my yoga class with me. It's not, do you practice yoga? Da 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 da. It's, you should come to my yoga class with me, specifically, over and over again. And I think it's really interesting to be, to sort of look the part, which is another kind of, you know, like, to, because I'm a brown woman, so I look the part of somebody who has a relationship to yoga, but I don't really have a relationship to yoga. I have a shoulder disability that keeps me from being able to do a lot of yoga. And I also come from a household that has zero interest in sports whatsoever. It's not just yoga. Like, nobody in my family cares about sports. My dad doesn't, you know, my sibling doesn't. So I also, you know, have over the years been sort of spoken to as though I do yoga, as though I know yoga, just because I look like somebody who does yoga, I guess, or I seem like somebody who does yoga. So I think that there's that question too. It's sort of like the question of, you know, who is this for, which is the, you know, of course, the title of the book. And then also, if you trace yourself outside of that, you know, like, if you sort of have these inheritances or traditions, but you maybe don't want to engage with them in the first place. I think that got brought up for me as somebody who sort of feels like kind of like simultaneously locked out of yoga because of a disability. And also somebody who feels sort of like, I don't know if I have an interest in yoga. And I feel like that should be okay too, you know, alongside, do you know what I mean? Like, I should get to, like, like, I like lifting weights. That's my wellness, you know, which is a little, I do stretch, but I don't think of stretching as yoga. I take yoga seriously as a very vast realm of thinking and experience.
I love that you talked about, like, people assume that you like fit the description, because I don't. And it's so frustrating being someone who is, like, studied in these practices and that, like, finds them to be, like, the heart of their wellness, when people just, like, immediately take you out of the conversation because you don't look like a yogi. And I think that was a big part of why I wanted to start having conversations with Black women who are wellness practitioners, because we have this like profile of what someone who practices wellness is supposed to look like. And when we think about yoga, we're either thinking about the bindi white girl or we're thinking about the bindi brown woman, and we're assuming that the brown woman is bindi. And it's so much bigger than that. And then on top of that, if there is a person of African descent that practices these things, it's, well, do you bring in drums? Did they practice it in Africa? I know there's Kemetic yoga, which I think is a really beautiful practice, but that's not the yoga I practice. And much of my meditation study was done in Malaysia. So I'm like, I don't have those kinds of connections and those kinds of assumptions. Just make me very frustrated.
There is too, like, this freedom of this moment. Like, okay, so all this bad shit came out of capitalism and colonization, but also, like, can we also make it that we're free to choose whatever we want? We can do the things that resonate with us.
Yeah. You know, one thing that I'm thinking also is, like, yoga has become so narrow in the West. People think yoga is just the yoga. Like, I don't do yoga classes to feel like I have a back injury. I cannot do, like, the only yoga I've ever enjoyed was on Zoom with my aunties, because it's not the same as what they make me do in class. Otherwise, I'm a kickboxer recently and I'm enjoying that, but not this Western version of yoga. However, sitting meditation is also yoga. Painting is yoga. Love and sex are yoga. Sex is yoga. I mean, if done with as yoga. So I think, you know, we just think of this one, like, physical exercise. That's one type of yoga across, like, I think there are four specific in Hinduism types of yoga. Also, washing dishes is yoga. Like, Hindus put a lot of emphasis on service and work, like daily work as a yoga practice. So I think, you know, if we just go, again, it's like all going back to the roots, right? Learning the roots of this is, I think, then I think people would start to understand, like, what the point of yoga in, like, the physical way is, which is mind, body, spirit union. And any practice that can bring that, you know, like sex, you know. I'm publishing a book chapter called Finding God in the Bedroom. So I'm plugging that here in this book club.
Look it.
Well, and her conversation about sex was one of the parts of the books that just, like, jumped out at me a lot, because, I mean, this is not the fun stuff, but when she was talking about sexualization, it just really triggered something for me, for how little Black girls are sexualized and how they're not allowed to have that space of, like, blossoming. I think there was, like, one space where she talked about adolescence and how that was a construction of society, that it's not a real thing that exists. We're humans from birth to death, and we go through different cycles. We put these labels on them in order to be able to do so many things, but it really is a control mechanism, right? So what if we didn't put these labels and we didn't sexualize our children? What does that look like as far as, like, their freedom and their evolution and their wellness is concerned as they mature into, like, different cycles of life? And I'm not sure where I was going to go with that tangent, but you brought up sex and I was like, that part of the book was really cool.
Yeah. And like, the other side, and this is The Birth of Pleasure, is a book that Amelia recommended to me a million billion years ago, where she writes about, like, so there's the sexualization of children, and then there's the tamping of the natural sexualization of human beings. And it's this sort of external decision for what's appropriate based on, like, what they want from you. That makes it really, really hard to figure out what you want from yourself in a moment.
Well, and that freedom, the freedom to be able to explore sexually, is incredibly racialized in my experience. I certainly did not have that freedom growing up because there were so many different things put upon what it meant to be a young Black female presenting person that I wasn't out doing a lot of the experimentation that my white counterparts were doing because it wasn't safe, because the stakes were much higher for someone in my body to do those things. So what does it look like when we allow that freedom to happen across the board, not just for people who are white presenting?
What would it be like to not be afraid of it? You know, like even as a parent.
And there's so much fear tied up in sexuality because of the consequences.
Yeah, I'm thinking about just like our bodies not being our own. And then of course that being incredibly racialized and also gendered. And, you know, I think, I also think that's partly why things like yoga have been so important for everyone, not just South Asians, because I actually do find yoga to be one of the most important interventions for sexual trauma healing. I think everybody who has experienced any level of sexual trauma, including subtle sexualization of their bodies, to be able to find union again, right, with self, heart, body, spirit, reclaim their bodies. And I think for me, like the physical yoga and meditation has been essential for that. Yeah.
I would love to talk a little bit about meditation, if you're up for it. This is something that's fairly new to me, Rachel. You know, I've been like sort of like seeking around it for a little bit. And a friend of mine gave me a class that I've been taking very slowly. Like, so they send me the recording and it's like every few weeks I'll take this class. And one of the things that really is the hardest for me is believing myself, right? So I'll like, I'm trying to follow this guided meditation and the entire time I'm like, Seema, you are making this up. Like, right? Like what I'm seeing, like, oh, you picked that ladder. And it's like, no, that's the thing, right? So like these two voices, I'm like, this is the ladder I'm seeing. And I'm like, oh, you just think that's pretty. There's like a part of me that's doing this that it's the detractor voice, right? That's like, I think there's some kind of consciousness inside me that's bad, right? And that's like, maybe the root of why I'm meditating is I'm trying to get rid of that consciousness, which, you know, Rachel, talk to me about this.
Like my immediate reaction is that's the voice you need to sit with, right? So we have this idea about meditation of what we think it's supposed to be. And what it really is presence with yourself. And so that voice that's coming in and telling you this is a bunch of, I don't know if I can curse, but this is a bunch of bullshit, is the voice that you want to lean into. And a lot of times when I'm doing guided meditation, I'll invite my students to lean into the thing that they are resisting, because that's the thing that shuts you off from meditation, right? You're like, every time I sit down and I think I'm supposed to be in this like beautiful space where I hear birds and I'm sitting by this imaginary lake, this voice comes in and is like, yeah, you're an idiot. You need to talk to that voice. You know, that is your meditation work. Because again, meditation is about being present with the self and moving through those layers of the self to get to that higher understanding, and also understanding that it's about cycles. When we talk about like the path that you move through as far as like yoga is concerned, it's not linear. It's not, I get to enlightenment and then I stay there. You're gonna do this like loopy, zigzaggy thing. And the whole point is the practice every day to be present with whatever you shows up for your practice and be in a space of observation and acceptance and reception, not resistance.
I think about how meditation, like all those apps now that are coming out around meditation, or the more like types of meditation that are like more rooted in capitalism. What's missing from that maybe is that it is like an ongoing thing. Like you said, Rachel, like you don't get to some point and then like, oh, I'm fine now, so I can delete this app and go about my business. Like it's got to be something that like, it's not just something that's being presented with to you. It requires like you to be doing self-examination, which I think is not it's not the quick fix that people want.
These are not one-off activities. These are things that are a part of a I'm going to use the word lifestyle. I don't really like that word, but it's a part of your life, you know? So like the point is not to get to the end of the meditation. The point is not to do the instructions to a T. The point is to be present in whatever that moment offers. And a lot of times, because of capitalism, we're very goal oriented because that's what we can sell, right? If you take this meditation course, by the end of it, you'll, you know, feel like you're less stressed and you'll feel like you have tools to like manage your life. And you might feel that way while you're in the class, and then you may finish the class and then everything comes crashing down again. And you're like, oh my God, I need to take that class again. Right. So, you know, it's worked when really sit with the mess, sit with what it feels like to be messy. We don't want to do that, but it's such a part of the human experience to be messy, to make mistakes, to be. I love that in the book, she talked about the ways that she screwed up in life and that she still had value as a human being, not because she was some like altruistic, all-knowing, enlightened being, but because she is a human being no matter what she does. And if people don't want to receive her, that's their problem. She's still going to be who she is.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. I'm just thinking like the more we're talking about it, the more I think like everybody needs to meditate or do yoga. Like I agree with like early founders of yoga and like, and right, like this literally like global domination and all of this. I think this is where peace and love lie as a practice. And I, you know, so any way to spread that for me is good. Like I can't go to sleep at night without my insight meditator on my phone guiding me through a yoga nidra meditation for 20 minutes. That's how I go to sleep. And I was an insomniac before this app, and this has radically transformed my well-being. However, just like you said, Rachel, like it takes a lot to undo the Western American, also like capitalistic mindset. And I think that's exactly what meditation and yoga, if done repeatedly as a practice, accomplishes, which is like the transcending of your ego, which is the part of you that's like judging everything, chattering everything. And it's always there. I mean, I don't know if you know The Untethered Soul by Michael Singer. He does this great, he talks about when he first learned to meditate, just in, like he just learned there was a voice talking to him at all times and talking about him and commenting, running this judgmental commentary. And that's what initiated him into meditation, was learning, becoming curious of the voice and learning to relate to it. Yeah. And that's what meditation is.
Yeah, absolutely. And again, like we're taught that we need to fix these things. You know, when we think about how our brains work, when one brain doesn't work the way another brain works, it's like, well, we have to fix that. So how can we fix that? Instead of how can we be present with it? How can we understand it? How can this be something that can be a help or a support to this person, as opposed to how can we erase this thing? Because really, you can't. It's a part of your nature, you know?
Right. But there is so much shit I do to try to, like the things like, you know, like to Darfia's point, like working out, like lifting weights or like running, or like the thing I like about a lot of these things is that I'm not thinking.
But that's the other thing. And I want to go back to Nisha's point. A lot of the things that we don't call yoga are yoga. A lot of the things that we don't call meditation are meditation. If when you run, you are able to clear your mind, then that's your meditation moment. That's your yoga moment, you know? You can do the other thing too. Like that if that you want that to be part of your practice, but it doesn't have to be this thing that has been sold to us. It can be anything that helps you be present with yourself.
I just want to say something about how I feel like meditation has also been co-opted by tech bros, which makes me not want to do it. It really makes me not want to do it. Like, I dated this dude for a second. This is my revenge, is talking about him in this conversation. But literally, like, you know, because like when we went on a date or two, like I looked at his Twitter and literally it was like he had like a profile picture, and then his, you know, that banner thing in the back, I don't know what that's called, the wallpaper or whatever, was like a picture of him like in meditation. And it made me so mad because I just was like, see everybody's reactions. Anyway, I just wanted to add that to the conversation because I just sort of feel like there's like a I feel resistance to meditation because of the performance of meditation and because of the smugness with which people tell me I should meditate, like makes me not want to do it. And then when I do it, I get so much out of it, but I have to like override so much frustration at the, I don't even know whether to call it co-opting or commodification of it, but I just, you know, like, and I'm the kind of person who's like, I'm not going to do that while it's trending. You know what I mean? Like I'm like a cranky person who doesn't like doing stuff while it's trending. So I feel, I both love meditation when we're talking about sort of like, let's call it the kind of like pure source of the thing, which is what I hear y'all talking about. Kind of there's an OG meditation that belongs to no one, that is not sold, that is sort of accessible to the self, that, you know, like when we are in, we can get there, you know, like we can get there without a tech bro telling us that we should do it. But I definitely feel more resistance to it because of the tech bros. So
it's also like somebody took that picture. Like he had somebody take that picture. Like some like
timer. He used his timer. 100%.
I don't know. And it's like, it doesn't sound like this tech bro was like his tech company was not anything to do with meditation, but that is still like how he was choosing to like present himself. Sorry, I just wanted to just reiterate that happened.
Yeah, no. I really appreciate that because I think vengeance might be part of my wellness practice. So I don't know.
This is the thing too, right? Like the tying of wellness to some kind of virtue is like really like a lot of the places of self-sacrifice and suffering that haven't been healthy, that have to do with like denying oneself nutrition and right, all of these ways that we feel where we equate wellness with virtue. And by we, I mean literally me. And, you know, like genuinely, if I'm honest, I would love to say that it's like something else outside of me that I've just noticed, but like, it's me, I'm doing it. And then I get this glee at rebelling against myself. But right, like, and so like we create this like binge wellness that's like virtue and then falling way off the wagon and this back and forth. When my younger son was small, he would go through days where he would like eat hardly anything, and then another day where he would eat everything. And the doctor said to me then, like, think about it over a few days, not one day. And I think it's so often we're told like it's just you've got to be this thing all the time, which isn't, for me anyway, just not possible. I have to have the Cheetos day. I have to have or else I feel like maybe really sorry for myself, or maybe really like embarrassed by how trendy I'm being, to Darvia's point. Like I just like want to rebel against it.
I think that's the beauty of this book. And I think that's why many of us, when we first started reading it, were like, what is this? How is this a wellness book? And it's like, no, it is taking the veil away. And it's saying, humans are messy. And we're not going to get it right every day. And you should eat the Cheetos because I plan on eating some things over here. I love fruit snacks. I always have them in my refrigerator. They're fantastic. And I also love cake. And that's okay. What I think is beautiful about real wellness is that it acknowledges our humanity, that our humanity is a part of the conversation. And that when we're really practicing wellness and healing, we're not just sitting down with the parts of ourselves that we think have the most virtue. We're also in conversation with the parts of ourselves that are hurting, that are dark, that make us feel uncomfortable because they have value as well. And when we get to a space of balance, it's not when those parts go away. It's when we're able to sit down with them without fear. It's when we're able to sit down with them without feeling like we need to erase them, that we need to shove them into a corner and bring everybody into a huddle and see the value of all of the facets of our humanity, as opposed to this kind of, you know, virtuous thing that we think is going to just block out all of the darkness, right? That's not balance.
The idea of virtue is really interesting in light of the word coming up for me when I was hearing Tarfia talk about this person that she dated was like spiritual bypassing or spiritual narcissism as well, which I think is like the gross thing that comes, and often with white people, I will say, who then like white splain our own people's spirituality to us, which can be very off-putting, especially if they're not understanding the actual roots of something. And what is actually happening is a spiritual bypassing or spiritual narcissism, which it seems like that's the case given this photo. But it's everywhere. I see it everywhere in yoga culture, everywhere. But I also, in Faria's book, really, one of the things that I valued most was her going back to the idea of like the original intention of yoga is ethics. It's being a good person, but there is a pretending to, you know, seeming like a good person or talking yourself up as a good person. And then there really is being a good person. To me, what that means is unflinching ability to observe your own humanity and the human, like to know your shadow and your, you know, your, all of your parts and see it. And that to me is like part of why I keep thinking like meditation needs to be done by everybody, because it is a vehicle to that literal level of self-awareness without which people project their shit or do this or try to like put other people down by bringing themselves up. And like, if you can watch all of that happen, you're, and then just meditate and sit with it, you're way less likely to act it out. So I think it is the route to being an ethical person, but that's not the same as virtue signaling. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, she makes a distinction that I really love between being better and being whole in the book. And I really responded to that because of what being whole looks like versus what being better looks like. And they can certainly share a Venn diagram type space, but it's, yeah, I think acknowledging the parts of me that do feel hurt and sadness and anger, and then, you know, as a result, sometimes end up hurting myself or other people as a result of it. I mean, there's always just, you know, like, I just think that progress and healthiness includes regression. Like, it has to. Those kind of like just the disruption of regression is actually a very powerful healing tool in a way. It's not a linear path at all. And I really appreciate how she draws that aspect of wellness out, because I also feel very suspicious of a culture that is sort of like good vibes only, you know, live, laugh, love. Like, but I'm, again, like I'm always the person in the corner kind of rolling my eyes at that kind of copy, in part because I think for me, wellness has been this like rigorous, really almost kind of like bloody, just like almost violent, you know, kind of like passage. Like, I really had to fight for it, because I think depending on how deeply entrenched you are in your shadow or how much your shadow is taking over, like, I mean, I think you have to, it is kind of like fighting your way through the woods.
I like that you described your wellness journey as like a bloody passage, because it's like, that's the thing, right? It looks very sunny and full of dream catchers on Instagram. But like the experience of like trying to get well, I mean, I don't even know if it's to get well. It's like get less bad or like just trying to move through to the next level of yourself, right? Which is really what it is. It's not an external measure. It's like, what is the next level of me based on where I am today, where I was yesterday? And to your point, right, like with the regression, it might be that the next level requires me going through yesterday to tomorrow. And I really loved that you said that, because I think that's what makes people give up, is like they're like surprised by how messy and bloody and painful and uncomfortable and like full of failure the process is.
Yeah. And I'm thinking also like part of the issue with like Western wellness culture stuff in Rachel's point about like, oh, this is the goal I'm going to do yoga for. Like, I think it's good to like do yoga and meditation, whatever. But at the end of the day, like the ways I've evolved have come from like nervous breakdowns I've had that I did not will upon myself, that literally happened in the trenches of my trauma that I like, you know what I'm saying? Like I couldn't connect to this book emotionally, but I knew 5 years ago I would have been bawling. And part of like what happened in the last 5 years is like I had a spiritual emergency that like the West would call a manic episode, which is becoming my next research project. I just choose myself as a social experiment as a psychologist. But you know, like survived it and didn't die, did not get medicated, went the shamanic route with it, and had an amazing community of people that like supported it. And like that shifted my consciousness. And it, you know, it got me, it was very spiritual. It was exactly what Faria was talking about, is like the original, you know, philosophies of like everybody being divine. It's the reason I have self-love now, is because during that state of consciousness in which I was mad, I realized we're all God, including me. And, you know, like, and that stuck with me. And now I'm very grounded in material reality 4 years later. And I teach this stuff and like, you know, I did not do anything except for have insane amounts of trauma after calling off my engagement and dealing with like infantile attachment stuff coming up to initiate me into that. That was not me like meditating or going to therapy once a week or whatever. That was like some dark night of the soul that I was initiated into and that I had a loving community to support me with without, honoring the wisdom of what was happening, you know? And it was bloody, but it was also like absolutely divine.
Well, and isn't that what wellness is for, right? Like wellness isn't this place where you maintain an immaculate space. Like wellness is the tool that comes in and helps you to manage when the space is crumbling. I remember I did this silent meditation retreat and it was in this beautiful temple. And, you know, I got to work with a guru and we were chanting and we were having all of this like amazing, like meditative, like revelation space time. And when I got ready to leave, my guru said to me, your real work happens when you leave this temple, right? So this idea that, you know, it's all like the temple space. I mean, unless you're planning on taking orders and even that's complicated, like the real work happens when you get into reality and there are people who are not on a path to practice and there are real like confrontations that are going to happen when you have this vision for who you want yourself to be in a world that does not care. And it is ugly, you know? And this broad brush that we paint that wellness is this flowery space is part of the reason why it is failing people.
This thing you said, in a world that does not care, it's like, this dude with the photo is really like a trending topic, but like this is the thing, right? It's like, what does it mean in a world where we are really, like, maybe more than any other world ever, trying to be watched at all moments, but actually doesn't care about our wellness, actually doesn't care about our healing, and maybe is not served by it, right? Like, consumerism is really runs on our hunger. It runs on our, like, not feeling like enough. I'm going to buy the tonic and the water and the dress and the shoes and, right? Like, but only if I'm hungry. So, like, the whole thing is designed to keep me hungry. And so it's this, like, really radical thing to decide to be quietly, messily getting well.
I would argue, though, that it's also incredibly radical to be visibly present and trying to be well. And I know we're talking about the guy in the photograph as virtue signaling, but I also know how powerful it has been for me to see people who look like me represented in this space. And I've been that person. I'm like, some Black lady who's, you know, over 40 with bad hips is gonna see me doing my best to sit in meditation and think, well, she can do it, I can do it, right? And so I think that there's no one way to really kind of do this wellness thing. It really depends on your intention behind your journey, you know? Maybe your intention and your need is to be quietly, messily well, and that's okay. And then maybe there's someone like me who's like, I want to be as visible as possible because I want people to see that it's possible for them.
Yeah, that's so interesting. Because what came up for me as you were saying that is, like, sometimes I feel like wellness in particular is like a place where I can be allowed to be selfish. Like, it's not about anybody fucking else, right? It's not like, right? Like, I thought, like, I do plenty to serve the world. And, like, this will not be that. And that's, like, what came up, but you're absolutely right, because it is. It's like somebody gives me a little nudge or a reminder, somebody that I respect and admire and relate to, this book, right? Like, gave me this opportunity. It gave me this nudge to be like, no, go deeper into yoga. Don't be like, oh no, that they've co-opted it. It's trendy. It's annoying to me. I don't want the beads. But this book did make me feel like, okay, there's, like, you know, like, she did, and give me this invitation to, like, no, go deeper into it, own it, be part of it.
I think that, I mean, it's interestingly, like, part of what I was realizing about the feeling of dissonance with the book, but an understanding of, like, spiritual emergency Nisha, really, like, feeling saved by this book. And then, like, where I'm at right now is, like, I think coming from what happened to my consciousness was that I'm seeing love in more places than I saw it before. And whereas I was more hopeless before and seeing only the evils of the world and the oppression of the world, now and I think it came from, like, seeing everybody as a part of the divine, was having, like, much more faith in the loving parts of humanity. And how that's shifted my activism has become, like, community organizing in my classrooms, like, with my students and my colleagues and whatever. And I can do this because, like, I was, like, I think, like, saved by the love of a community. Like, I would say, like, 25 people's love during one of the worst times of my life that held me through something. And that was like, oh my God, like, more like, and such a unique kind of love. And I was like, oh, this is real and it saves people. And I want to be a part of this and keep nurturing it and finding it where it exists. And it really has come into, like, I think, like, my activism has just gotten so love-based. You know, I do basically, like, queer racial justice work in rural Georgia. And literally, like, with my students, we just community organize in the classroom. That's what we're doing. And they're so amazing. And it's majority students of color in the classroom at the undergrad level. Half of them are queer, but grew up in the Baptist church. And I don't know, I'm just seeing love everywhere. And so I think that's what's also really interesting. I don't know, I just want to kind of share that. And I wouldn't have seen it without a really traumatic and mad experience.
I appreciate thinking about this book as a kind of litmus test or metric about where one is in space and time, because I mean, I think this goes back to that moment that really affected me, which is making a distinction between what is to be better and what it is to be whole, and how, you know, with the dude in the photograph, which is, you know, it's kind of like such a both and situation where this is also somebody who I care about, even though I felt, you know, sort of like judgmental of him because I also felt rejected by him. Right. So there's like a whole kind of like process that's happening that is sort of like is going to inevitably get reduced to like some soundbite of like, you know, like Darfia doesn't think that, you know, pictures of people meditating are cool, or I don't know, you know, it's going to get reduced to that. Like it's going to get reduced no matter what I say or do. Right. But I think like, I too found myself sort of being like, okay, like I'm further along than I think I am on some things. And then, you know, I have more work to do in other arenas. And, you know, like, I also sort of like, I think like it, I feel sometimes that I occupy a kind of a little bit of a hater stance in a way, just because like, I'm suspicious of what is fed to me. Do you know what I mean? Like I have like a deep suspicion of authority, and a rejection of being told how I should be, because a lot of the ways that I was told to be didn't work for me. Like I had to, you know, figure it out. And therefore reject people who were telling me in an authoritarian way to do something that had worked for them. So I appreciate, as always, the complexity of what we're talking about.
I'm really interested in this word epistemicide, which I've only like really encountered in academic spaces and like in little bits that like just like runs through this book. Yeah, I would love to hear what people like are thinking about around this erasure of ways of forming knowledge.
I'm absolutely citing it in an upcoming publication. This came at like the perfect time for like a peer-reviewed article I'm writing about reclaiming Indian epistemologies. And I've never heard of the word, what is it, epistemicide? And I'm like, this is brilliant. So I'm just, yeah, synchronicities. Literally, it came like the publication is due next week, and that's going to be my conclusion, citing her.
How did you feel about finding that word then? Because this has been your word.
Brilliant. Divine intervention to get this publication done. I don't even know what to say. I think this woman is brilliant. I just, yeah.
I love having a word. It took me a minute for the word to land, but it's interesting in a lot of the conversations I've had with wellness women on my podcast. We always talk about where did you get your first experience of wellness, and so many of those traditional practices that happened in the home and our slave ancestors who had their ways of healing each other in a very, it's incredibly horrific situation, and how so much of that has been passed down through music, through dance, through the way we commune with each other, and how so much of that is consistently being demonized and torn down as a form of control. It was great to have a word for it as well. I'm not writing anything in particular, but I do think that there's power in being able to call it by a name and being able to say, we recognize that this is what is happening and we are going to take that power back, right?
It's like become one of the most important things to me. If I just think about, you know, this idea of, say it again, epistemicide.
Epistemicide, I think.
Epistemicide.
I never read it. This sort of like really sort of violence of this dominant way of thinking of everything has to be reproducible externally in order for it to be true and in order for it to be worthy. But then, like, truthfully, placebos are so useful, right? That's reproducible. It's just not, like, very saleable. And so, yeah, sorry, go ahead, Nisha.
Oh, I was thinking of, like, that also being, like, so the Western scientific model, right, of logic and rationality and the scientific method. And, like, I don't operate that way. I mean, I have some logic. Like, I'm trying to run an HOA. I have some logic. but also, a lot of how I'm, like, trying to run the HOA is based on gut feelings and intuition and, like, some spiritual knowledge guiding me on things that are going awry. And to have the permission to, like, yeah, I'm just going to go with it. Like, make finance, you know, like, suggest financial decisions based on another source of wisdom than just something very specifically logic-based as our evidentiary source that's coming from intuition about who to hire or not hire, about what could, you know what I'm saying? Like, those kinds of things. It's like, really, I think exactly what we were talking about, the last book club. This other kind of wisdom that is really respected and revered and harnessed in the East, in India and South Asia, and completely devalued here, you know? And it's just giving me permission to be like, that way of knowing is valid. That's a valid way of making my life decisions. It's a valid way of publishing scholarship in academia. And I don't have to feel bad or stupid or inferior for having the mind I have, you know?
I've been thinking especially about, like, how exciting it is to live in a moment where we can contribute to a lineage of thought. Because I don't think the old ways, I'm not trying to get back to the old ways. Let me tell you something. The old ways, people's teeth fell out. Like, things were not good. Things, right? Like, it was hard, the old ways. But I think that there is that the thing about epistemicide, the thing about ancient epistemologies is that we can apply them just as the tools of science get more precise, and so we can learn more about atoms. We can apply these old tools to current moments and create a new set of knowledges, and not, you know, like, we're not going to be able to divide our cultures away from each other. And I don't want to. Like, I want to know about, you know, like, what people on the African continent have been learning and doing and evolving. And I want to be able to participate in that in some way. And I want, you know, I want to have access to all of these ways of knowing. And it feels like this question of who is wellness for in this book is like saying, like, yeah, do it, but learn, you know, like, do the work to know the history of the thing, and you'll get more from it if you do.
Thanks for listening to CBAW Loves. A huge thank you to Tarfia Faizullah, Nisha Gupta, and Rachel Heath for being a part of this episode. We want to hear what you're thinking about wellness and what you thought about who was wellness for. So write to us at cbawloves@cbaw.org to share your thoughts. Next month, we'll be reading Why Fish Don't Exist by Lulu Miller. CBAW Loves is a community building artworks podcast produced by Amelia Bain with music by Rose Blakelock.
CBAW is committed to mission belonging, reconnecting veterans with their communities.
For more information, visit our website, www.cbaw.org.